The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon and this container and do the other thing.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to the Monday Space Show. It's great to be back, and thank you all for listening. Let's run through the announcements and then right into our program. For those of you who would like to call us, our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. No call screeners. Please let the phone ring until we can answer it, and we'll bring you up on the air as quickly as possible. For those of you wanting to use email, dmlivings@yahoo.com, drspace@thespaceshow.com, and thespaceshow@gmail.com. For those of you using chat, we're on the AOL family, so we have IMICQ and CompuServe. The screen name is the same for all three of these services, one word, space. Show chat. Please remember we're copyrighted and trademarked, but you can copy these shows and download them and put them on a CD, a memory stick, anything you want in order to distribute the programs and get the word out about why space development is important for everybody. Please, nothing commercial with the shows and no changes in the text of any of the interviews. We thank Andrew over at Gigadial.net. He does provide our podcasting service. The RSS URL is on our website, both newsletters. We're iTunes compatible, and we're in Podcast Alley. If you have any problems with our podcast, please send a note to drspace@thespaceshow.com, and we'll see if we can't resolve the problem with you. Visit our website, which is thespaceshow.com, and our comprehensive newsletter is there about, maybe a fourth of the way down. You can't miss it. It's uploaded fresh every Monday morning, but it also is where we make changes, so check it from time to time to see if a program has changed. The comprehensive details of each show for the week are there, plus we have future events listed there as well. You can get a short one- or two-line description of each program for the week sent to you in the email newsletter, also Monday morning, California time. Send a request to drspace@thespaceshow.com. Remember, everything we're doing is archived, and you can get it on our website. We have a store on our website, and you'll see the Support the Space Show button. Remember, we're a nonprofit 501c3 with One Giant Leap Foundation. We definitely need your support. We thank those of you who have contributed to us. It is very helpful. We couldn't be doing this without you. So thank you. And for those of you who are considering it or who need a tax donation, keep us in mind. And thank you for that. One hold the date I'll give you for the remainder of this year is the Advanced Technology Working Group, ATWG, December 9th through the 11th at NASA Ames. I'll be there for part of it, working that conference. So if you can attend, do so. You can get more information at atwg.com. And that's it I have for 2008, unless somebody wants to send me some more items. 1 week left to use the Mars Society fax tool to communicate about space to your favorite presidential candidate or both of them. http://fax.marssociety.org. Remember, we're also in Facebook, MySpace, and Twitter. And here's an announcement for all of you. Get a pencil, please. About a year ago, I was part of a documentary by a German film crew that first played in Europe, and it's been playing there all year in Europe. It's called Calling All Aliens. And it's actually a documentary about SETI and related SETI things. They came to the Space Show because I do deep space messages that all of you know about. and where listeners or guests or friends of the Space Show get a chance to record up to a 5-minute message of some sort to send to Deep Space, courtesy of Jim Lewis over at Communications Concepts in Cape Canaveral. Well, it has finally come to the United States. The show is called Calling All Aliens, and it will be on your cable National Geographic channel. And it's about the search for ET intelligence and SETI, the Allen Telescope Array, and collecting scientific data from the far reaches of the universe, and scientists who decode while communicating to determine if we do make contact or if there's a universal language set of markers. And there's about a 3-minute segment of me in the Space Show Studios doing a deep space message. So it's going to show in the United States Saturday, November 1 at 10 p.m. You need to confirm what times these are in your local time zone. Sunday, November 2nd, 10 p.m. Monday, November 3rd, 1 a.m. Sunday, November 9th, 3 p.m. And go to the nationalgeographic.com/TV and then -schedule, and you can find out what it is. It's a 1-hour show. And I'm already getting reports from people who are seeing it in Australia that my segment is in it. So you might check it out, and I'll be announcing it on other Space Show programs. Okay, on to our show today with Luis Riofrío. And Luis is an unusual person, an out-of-the-box thinker, very creative person, a scientist and a developer of projects. And she's going to discuss the fact that she has a really cool positive pressure spacesuit, which she has modeled at various conferences. I've seen her modeling it at several where I've actually been to here in San Francisco, as well as ISDC and others. And she has cosmology theory. She is an undergraduate, as an undergraduate, predicted that the speed of light is slowing, and she came up with the equation GM equals TC. What is it, Louise, cubed? How do I say that?
GM equals TC cubed.
TC cubed. Okay, my math is not as high level as yours. And it may solve the dark energy problem. And more recent research has found evidence of black holes in unexpected places, even inside the Earth. And in the everyday world, Louise has design suggestions, and they have been adopted by NASA for the next-gen Constellation spacesuit. She's a full-time researcher in cosmology, and you can follow along with some of what we're talking about today. Her website is http://riofrio.com. Louise, welcome to the Space Show. How are you today?
Oh, very good, David, and thank you for inviting me.
My pleasure. And let's start out with your cosmology theories, and if you can get me to follow along with you and understand, then you have a giant success on the Space Show, because unfortunately my math is not that high, and I never took a cosmology class in college. What I've learned is right here on the Space Show from guests such as yourself. So what is your theory, and what does this formula that you read off a minute ago tell us?
Well, David, and it's not that complicated, and I'll just give it to you in a nutshell. It starts out with a simple principle we learned from relativity, that space and time are really the same thing. And we're already hardwired to think that way. I mean, most people don't remember exactly how many kilometers away their home is from their work, but you can bet most people know exactly how many minutes it takes to get to work.
Absolutely true. Why is that?
Because we're already hardwired to think in terms of space and time as the same thing. And the conversion factor is just the speed of your vehicle. And it turns out that nature has its own conversion factor, which is the speed of light. And just in a nutshell, the speed of light determines how big the universe is. And the whole big universe can be described in a really simple equation. GM equals TC cubed, where G is Newton's constant, M and T are the mass of the age of the universe. That predicts that the universe expands, predicts why there's a Big Bang, and makes the astonishing prediction the speed of light isn't completely constant. It's been slowing down at a very tiny rate, at a rate that's been very difficult to detect until very recently. And almost recently, we have several experiments which combined appear to indicate that, as with the prediction, the speed of light is slowing down at exactly the rate that the math predicts. And it's actually all quite simple.
I remember reading about 5 years ago, I think, or maybe a little less than that, where they were talking about the speed of light was variable at or around the edge of a black hole. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, it turns out that lots of things affect the speed of light. Yes, one way to interpret what happens around a black hole is that the speed of light actually changes near a black hole. And we all know that light paths are curved by gravity. But by taking that further, we found that just as gravity slows everything else down, it can even slow down a beam of light.
Space and time. So when I think about time, I never think about space. And, you know, I never hear regular folks ever talk about space, but we talk about time all the time. So I don't even know how to phrase this question. If space and time are the same, why is our focus on time and not space?
Oh, well, it's just the time that we live in. Oh, for about 400 or 500 years, you know, we've had clocks and watches. And it's very easy to think of things in terms of time, how long it takes a job to be done or how long it takes to get somewhere.
Is space the same as distance? Are you using that as the same word?
Yes, we measure space by distance.
So you could say space is the same as distance?
Yes, where the conversion factor would be the speed of light, meters per second, space over time, it's the velocity.
I understand now why I never took a cosmology class, Elise. You have a caller who is already eager to talk with you. Are you there, caller? Caller, are you still with us? Hello? I guess our caller got lost off the phone, so this happened yesterday with us, too, so maybe the caller will call back. We've made that line available again. What is the significance of your formula and your discovery?
Oh, well, it actually solves a lot of things. In fact, some scientists have said, perhaps kindly, that it's the most profound mystery in science. But more recently, you know, in the past 10 years, there have been some readings that appeared to say that the universe isn't slowing down, but it's accelerating. And some people in Berkeley found that by looking at the redshifts of distant supernovae, exploding stars. You know, they found out that there are redshifts that appear to be accelerating, and that part of the universe is accelerating away from us. But it turns out that those redshifts are just measured in relation to the speed of light, just B over C. And again, it's really quite simple. What if it's not V that's accelerating, but C slowing down? And, when you insert that into the data, it explains the so-called accelerating data very precisely. So in other words, the universe might not be accelerating, but the speed of light is slowing down, making it look like the universe is accelerating.
So what is that? Does that have any meaning to us as inhabitants on Earth? Do we care if the universe is speeding up or if the speed of light is slowing down?
Well, you know, people are always worried that the world's going to end or that the universe is going to end. Whether from climate or warfare or something in nature beyond our control. But what this says is that the universe, it as a whole, really won't end, that it's going to muddle along. It'll never slow to a stop or collapse into a big crunch. It's just been expanding and slowing, and it's been doing that since it was no bigger than a basketball.
Does this negate the life expectancy of the sun, or I guess the universe could end if the sun ended, right?
Well, actually, it has a direct bearing on the problem of Earth's climate. And there's something called a faint sun paradox. According to our theories of how the sun developed, well, our life shouldn't have evolved on Earth at all, because when life was first arising some 4 billion years ago, the sun was too cold. Earth would have been frozen solid. But that can't be true, because all the geological and paleontological evidence is that billions of years ago, Earth had temperatures suitable for both liquid water and life. So something was missing from our theories of the sun, But well, as it turns out, the sun turns its fuel to energy according to E equals mc squared. Billions of years ago, C was exactly big enough so that the solar radiation was within a comfortable level. And when you look back over billions of years, instead of the sun steadily growing brighter, its luminosity has been nearly level. Turns out some things might really be constant, and the sun has been more or less constant for billions of years. And that's what's allowed our life to evolve, and that's why we're talking today.
Hal, this is a question from Paul in Denver, and he says, how mainstream or accepted have your theories now become, or are you still on the outside of mainstream science? And what does mainstream science provide to fill in the gaps that your theories seem to explain?
Oh, I found as a student that part of the history of scientific ideas is when an idea first comes out, there's a certain amount of resistance. There are always alternate ideas. Just as when people thought that Earth was the center of the universe and the planets circled the Earth, they had to invent epicycles, wheels within wheels, for the planets to circle in order to explain our observations. And though today's cosmology has come up with its own epicycles, and one of those is a so-called dark energy, the magical repulsive force that would cause the universe to accelerate. No such thing has ever been observed in a laboratory. No one's ever found an example of a repulsive force. It's just something invented to fill in the gap. And a long time ago there was an inflationary idea, an idea that the early universe expanded at warp speed, many times faster than light. Turns out that one might be an epicycle too. And with any new idea, then, there will be a little bit of resistance. Maybe you've seen that too.
Yeah, all the time. I personally don't know how to counter that. In fact, you have another question along those lines. Let me see if I can read it. This may be the person calling. I said it's too long. Call the show. Hold on a minute. This may be him. Space show.
Yeah, it's Charles, and I'll hold on. I'm not the dropped call.
No, you're not the dropped call, and you're not the call from the other person. But, Charles, welcome back to the show. And
I have a question.
This is Louise, so go for it.
Oh, okay. You had mentioned this intriguing business about light slowing down with time. Would there be any way to attempt an experiment of some sort to measure it, like maybe a very long laser interferometer? Or would the mechanical structure of the cavity of the interferometer shrink to compensate? But if we could measure probably one part per 100 billion or so by counting light wave lengths in a long interferometer, could such an experiment be cooked up?
All right. Actually, I'm glad you mentioned that, because actually that is the third experiment. The first two were the supernovae and the sun. The third one, we found the longest baseline possible. And, since 1969, there's been that set of reflectors on the moon. And we can bounce lasers off the moon. Now, it turns out that the moon is receding from the Earth, but anomalously high. The Lunar Laser Ranging Experiment measures that recession at 3.82 centimeters per year. However, again, geology disagrees. There are also geological markers over as to how fast the moon is receding. We get that from things as varied as coral reefs and the sedimentation in various regions. And the most accurate measurements say that the moon has been receding at only 2.9 centimeters per year.
So that difference implies a reduction of the speed of light by a certain significant factor per year. And could that be measured by a mechanical on-Earth interferometer structure that could be 100 to 200 meters long?
It could eventually if we had accurate enough clocks. At the moment, our Earth-bound measurements of C are not accurate enough to measure the slowing. The slowing is very tiny.
Well, I was suggesting not depend on clocks, but count wavelengths in a fixed-length interferometer. Wouldn't the number of wavelengths gradually increase if the speed of light were slowing down?
Again, it would happen at a very tiny rate, and Earth-bound experiments so far haven't been accurate enough. But to answer your question, they will be, and they will be very soon.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, Charles, thanks a lot. I appreciate
sure.
it.
Bye.
That frees up our telephone, everyone, and our toll-free line is 1-866-687-7223. Okay, let me see if I can read what John in Montana has to suggest or offer. I have two observations. First, peer review, whether for publications or for grants, by its nature tends to perpetuate orthodoxy. Second, although many people gripe about peer review, there are very few calls for change, and they hardly ever prove successful. Failed attempts at involved quotas for young investigator grants, removing reviewer anonymity, publication of dissenting views, along with controversial articles and others. Despite many hating peer review, I haven't seen anything better for science come along. What are your thoughts and suggestions on this? As a person who has borne the brunt of rather vicious attacks from orthodox physics, this is kind of something like you and I shared before the show started. Yeah, peer review can be horrible if you're not part of the mainstream.
Oh, yes, I have noticed that. But in general, it takes a long time for a good idea to get out there. You know, when other people write about things like the speed of light changing, they encounter great challenges in peer review and just in getting published in the first place. And, oh, yes, without getting too precise, there are definite ways that the system could be changed. Oh, just to mention one, I found that, the archive, the online archive of scientific papers at one time was founded intending to be a free exchange. But in more recent years, you know, has been come under control of people with politics that would turn anyone off. And I've encountered that firsthand. I mean, there should be a free country. There should be free exchange of ideas. There should be a marketplace of ideas. And ideas should be free to stand or fail upon their own merits.
That's what I say on the Space Show all the time. You took my words. We don't do any character assassination. I don't care who the person is. They speak their ideas and they stand the light of day or they don't, but you don't have to shoot or kill the person. But the political assassins are out to destroy the message by destroying the person. And it is really unfortunate, but also our media does it. So why shouldn't it happen in science as well? And I know NSF does it in how you get and apply for grants in NSF. It's a very political process. You have another caller. You ready? Caller, are you with us? Who keeps calling and then getting off the line? Hello? Well, somebody has a problem with a telephone. Okay, so call back, caller, 1-866-687-7223. Is there a sort of a neutral repository of online papers and publications that is not agenda-driven that you're aware of?
Not a large one yet. For a while, physics and astronomy were dominated by the online archive, but, you know, over the years, those have become a little bit biased. There are more neutral things, like, for instance, the astrophysics a digital library, which is, well, ads.harvard.edu, is a non-bias. It simply just records papers, you know, by their author.
Uh-huh.
By their author, no matter how small or how big the publication was. And I find that a more reliable way of disseminating information.
Let's see if our caller is back with us. Caller, are you there? Hello? Caller, are you there? Going once? Twice? Boy, Louise, somebody keeps trying to reach us, but they can't seem to make their phone work. So I don't know what to tell you about that. Maybe they need a scientist to help them. I don't know. Do you think that, well, one of the things we talk about a lot on space and space reporting is the poor quality of space and science journalism in general for the general public, not so much for the, you know, the in communities, the space community itself or something like that. Do you think that we need a more open and a more qualified press for reporting science and some of the things that you're talking about to the general public. I personally think the general public would be most interested in it if they could get, you know, good, adequate reporting and where the reporter actually understood what they were reporting.
Oh, yes, I think so. I think so. Journalism could definitely improve in this area, especially in science. I think that, you know, when there is an interesting idea or when someone actually achieves something, people should be positive about it. You know, we should believe in the things we do because our society and the people in it, you know, produce some great things, whether building things or just discovering new theories, and people need to be enthusiastic about that. I mean, I believe that in the 1960s, when people were going to the moon, there was a lot of optimism about science and technology. That was when a lot of great discoveries were made, not just in reaching the moon, but even in particle physics. And we need to go back to that. You know, we need to believe in ourselves and our ability to do great things.
What is your, of all the things that you're doing, because we're going to talk about your spacesuit in a little while and some of your other work that you do, is cosmology and your work with Speed of Light, is this your preferred favorite type of research and work, or are you much preferring spacesuit technology? What do you like to do most? Because you really are involved in a whole bunch of different arenas and different areas, and some of the disciplines may not even connect with each other.
Well, I'd say my first enjoyment and probably what I'll be most remembered for is the cosmology work. I mean, some of that is so unusual that it might not be recognized within our lifetime or even for a few decades. But I think that is the most long-lasting thing because that tells us, you know, truly about our origins, you know, how the universe started, you know, even how the planets were formed.
We're getting our cue from KKNW, so we're going to take our first break. Everybody stay where you are. We'll be back with Luis Riofrío, the person who's been trying to call. If you call during the break, you will not get put on hold, and maybe that way you can hold your phone connection. So give it a try, 866-687-7223. Back in about 2.5 minutes.
Listeners, for their generous support, the Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to The Space Show. Our guest today, Luis Riofrío. And Louise and I were just having a really interesting discussion during the break, given that we have a caller who doesn't seem to be able to connect with us. And Louise, you mentioned that we need probably bigger geo communication satellites with bigger dish antennas for better communication signals. Can you elaborate a little bit on that and tell us about that and where we are today with our communication satellites?
Oh, I'd be happy to. You know, everyone suffered from drop calls once in a while. because we rely on cell phone towers, which are haphazardly placed or wherever they can afford to put them. But these cell phones are only an interim technology. The next level is to build a true satellite phone. That require building a large communications dish in geosynchronous orbit, and we'll soon be able to do that. I mean, our space station is an enormous achievement, something we should be proud of, just the fact that we can build something 100 meters across in space. If we could build a similar size satellite in geosynchronous orbit, your telephone would talk directly to the satellite. You could have a telephone in your watch, even within your hearing aid. Even toys would have telephones that would work just as well on a yacht sitting in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. That would allow us, or the country that builds it, to completely leapfrog cell phone technology and move on to the next stage in communication.
How do you get by the lag time with geosynchronous communications?
Well, it would be used in combination with other things. Let's see, to reach geosynchronous orbit, well, it's the speed of light again, but for your phone to communicate with a satellite, the lag time is only about an eighth of a second, barely enough to notice.
What about, we already have satellite phones. Of course, they're not in geosynchronous orbit. They're in high low Earth orbit, or MEO. And I've used a few of them. They're, of course, a novelty and really costly per minute to use. And you need a lot of them to cover an area because they're not very high up. But you're talking about a different generation of satellite phone from what we have now with Globalstar and Iridium, right?
Yes, I'm talking about using the experience we have building the space station to build something useful, an orbiting communication raft that would allow you to put a phone anywhere.
And it could carry enough bandwidth to support, I guess, millions of users at one time?
Oh, yes, as many users as you want. But without getting too technical, there'd be room for all sorts of bandwidth and all sorts of wavelength. In fact, I think, the applications are difficult to imagine. I mean, you could conceivably use the satellite to communicate with devices in your own home.
There are people who want to develop space solar power, which I'm sure you're aware of, and beam solar energy back to rectana farms on Earth, for putting into our grid and for having power, and those satellites would be in geo as well. So are you talking about, let me phrase it this way, does a communication satellite platform that you're talking about beam the same kind of energy back to all of our different cell phones, or are you talking about something that overall is much simpler in transmitting through the atmosphere than what space solar power involves?
Yes, space solar power is a wonderful idea, but we're not quite ready to do that. The satellites for that would have to be kilometers across. But the communication satellite would be a very good interim step. Building a satellite at a size we're used to in a place we've been before. It would be an important step towards space solar power.
Are there any legs to this idea? I've not seen it, and nobody on the space show in 7 years of doing this program has ever mentioned something like this before. You're the first, Louise. So does this idea have legs in the literature? Or is it something new that you've thought of, or is it contagious?
Well, I've read similar ideas. I couldn't tell you offhand if there are any papers I could refer to. I think in his writings, Arthur Clarke wrote about some similar things without getting into too much detail. But actually, I've done some work on my own. It's not that complicated. You just take the wavelengths and do a few calculations to figure out how big an antenna you'd need and where to put it. And, well, I don't want to get too technical because I want to keep some of those ideas because, well, the consortium that puts this thing up will be wealthier than Bill Gates.
Here's another question from Dr. Jurist in Montana on chat with us. Your ideas have a major association with cosmology. Some people, like Dr. Tom Van Flandren, are trying to revitalize the Lesage gravitational theory or its variants. Do your theories account for some of the cosmological anomalies that Lesage gravity can potentially explain? How does it differ?
Well, I don't want to speak too much about another theory without knowing everything about it, but my own theory accounts for anomalies like the apparent acceleration of supernovae, the amount of dark mass, and even the amount of baryons. Now, scientists think that approximately 4% of the universe is baryons, the protons and electrons that we're made of. But the theory allows us to predict it exactly. So we are 4.507034% of the universe. You can calculate that to as many decimal places as you like.
And the known matter is that number?
Yes, the amount of the universe that is our kind of matter, protons, electrons, neutrons.
So the rest of it is dark matter and unknown, right?
Yes, so-called dark mass, things similar to black holes, things we can't see.
Interesting that we cannot come up with a real good handle on describing it or seeing it or anything like that. Why do you think that is?
Well, dark matter is an interesting puzzle in its own, and that's one of the other things that I've worked on. What's the identity of it? I mean, in a lot of ways, it behaves like black holes. So one thing the equation predicts is that black holes, even tiny ones, could in fact be very common in the universe. You know, even in our solar system, it's possible that, you know, at certain times in our history, some of the tiny black holes have collided with our planets and found their way into the cores. Would explain quite a lot of things about planetary formation. And yes, it's going to take a long time to get a sample of dark matter, but it could be either black holes or something very related.
Here's a question from Mel in Georgia, and said you've been talking about quite a few projects and subjects in cosmology, and I'm aware of your spacesuit project. What other projects are you currently working on, and are NASA and any of the new space companies interested in your spacesuit? I'm thinking of the companies that want to do suborbital tourism, and they need a survival suit for the spaceflight participants on an up-and-down flight.
Okay. So as the suborbital companies, in fact, some of them have approached me. Well, let's just say that the head of the number one suborbital company and also the chief competitor have separately approached me about the suit. Now, they won't be ready for a couple of years to actually buy them, because they have to develop their own spacecraft first, but they are very interested in the suit.
What about some of your other projects? You're involved in the cosmology projects that we've been talking about in the spacesuit. Other projects that you're involved in or work that you're involved in that are of interest?
Oh, one thing I've been working on recently, not an official basis, but contributing ideas, is the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer. And that's quite an important physics experiment designed for the space station. And it's already completed, paid for, and sitting in a clean room. It just needs a ride on the space shuttle to get it connected to the station. Unfortunately, the shuttle program is due to end in 2010, and they may not have room for one more flight for the AMS. And I've been looking at ways of getting the AMS on a shuttle, and one of them is quite unusual. It's led to a lot of arguments. Since this would be the last flight of the shuttle program, we can use it as an expendable booster. That is, use a shuttle to take this expensive instrument to the space station and then jettison the shuttle, either fly it home unmanned or burn it up in the atmosphere. It would be a very logical thing to do because since this would be the end of the program, there'll be no more need for that shuttle.
Well, maybe they'll extend it, but we don't know how many flights they'd extend it by. What a loss if they don't fly that, because the hardware is already there and already paid for. So I guess we'll find out in the next couple of months what the status is going to be on additional shuttle flights. But hopefully that experiment will go. Are you, let's see, what can you say about the fact that you may be going to Houston and doing some work with NASA? I know you mentioned it on the air, and I know there's only a little bit that you can talk about that, but I think that's pretty important, and congratulations are in order.
Oh, thank you. Yes, it's very, very exciting. But yes, I'll be moving to Houston, Texas full time now, because yes, there's great interest in the spacesuit by a certain government agency. In fact, some of the features of my spacesuit will end up on the next generation Constellation suit that's going to the moon. Now, simple things that the crew wants, like a flip-open visor and an entry in the back. And in general,
whoa, what do you mean an entry in the back? What do you mean by that?
There are different ways of getting into a spacesuit. The current suit is like a giant clam. It has a top section and a bottom section that have to be maneuvered together.
Right.
And in talking with astronauts, you know, they, for a lot of reasons, they prefer an entry in the back, either a zipper or some sort of hatchway.
Cool. So when they go to the moon, some of those features will be from you, but they're not going to use a mechanical pressure suit, are they?
Probably not for the moon, since the moon's only about 10 years away. And we already have, you know, they're hoping to do it with technology very similar to what they used in the 1960s. But for going further, especially to a place like Mars, they'll need a suit that's a much more comfortable and much more flexible, because going to Mars involves things like climbing and maybe even running. So they'll need a much more flexible and comfortable suit.
Does your suit, or can it be made to help shield for radiation on Mars, or is that beyond the capability of materials today?
Actually, it's quite adaptable to that. The suit has an inner pressurized layer and movable outer layers. And your outer layers can be adapted for different environments. You might have one set of outer layers for doing a zero-gravity EVA and a different outer layer for dealing with the surface of Mars. And when an astronaut is finished on Mars, she could leave her outer layer behind with all that icky Martian dust, and she'd still have a spacesuit to return home in.
It would also seem that your suit, the mechanical pressure suit, would be ideal for the space tourism flights, because they would not be bulky. They, you know, they'd need a lot less infrastructure and support hardware to make them work, and they'd be far more comfortable. Plus, they, you know, if they're going to look on the space tourists like they do on you, when I've seen you wearing them at conferences, the tourists are going to love them. Any comments on the tourist market, other than the fact that the two companies have talked to you? It just seems like it would be superb for an emergency survival suit, which is what a space tourism spacesuit really is all about.
Oh, yes, certainly, and that's what I've been talking to the companies about. As you've noticed, someone looks very attractive in the spacesuit.
Well, someone like you, if you put someone like me in it, it may not look that good, Luis. But especially form-fitting, you know, but what can I say? How do you cool that suit? You didn't look to be uncomfortable or hot when you were modeling it, but I understand heat dissipation for a spacesuit is a major factor.
Well, actually, for this suit, in a lot of ways, you get rid of heat in the normal way. As they say, men sweat, women glow. And that actually works better in a vacuum, because the material of the suit is actually porous. Your sweat goes right through the suit and evaporates in the vacuum of space. So your sweating is actually more efficient in space. But for walking around on Earth, as you've seen, we actually developed a miniaturized air conditioner. In fact, that's quite a fun device. It's about the size of a purse or a hardcover book. It actually, you can wear it around your neck. It cools the air and blows it into your face or into your hat. In fact, we're thinking of spinning that off as a separate product. Possibly by next summer, you'll see people walking around with mini air conditioners hanging around their necks.
You know, I was thinking of you because I was at the, this is way off target, but I was at the Cal, what the hell was the football game I was at 3 or 4 weeks ago in Berkeley, and it was a scorcher. I mean, it was, and the sun was right on top of us the entire game from about 2 in the afternoon till 5:30. And I'm thinking, surely there's a damn miniature air conditioner that people can have on a baseball cap or something. There ought to be something where you can at least cool your head and your neck and your face, maybe not your whole body. But, you know, everybody was just baking. It was so hot at the football game. Your air conditioner would solve that problem.
Yes, and they're actually quite inexpensive to mass produce. We'll even be able to sell them at the ball games.
What is the power source?
Oh, it's, Well, actually, it runs on water. That's not as unusual as it sounds, but if you fill it with ice or cold water, the heat transfer that vaporizes that water comes out of you.
So it doesn't run out of water.
Over the course of a hot day at the football game, you could run. You'd see that water disappear, but you can refill it in almost any place, or just go to the hot dog stand and ask for some ice.
Okay, so could you have a ball cap that's a solar collector and have it somehow wired to your hat to keep the sun off your face and let the sun power your little air conditioner?
Yes, we thought about them adding solar panels, and that would add to the unit cost because solar panels still have a cost, and we want to keep the cost low enough so you'll actually be able to buy it at the game, possibly with Cal logos on it.
I didn't go to Cal, so I don't care about that. I know you went to Cal, so. What kind of price range would this sell for at a football game? Seriously, have you given any thought to that?
Oh, yes, we want to keep this at a cost low enough that anyone can afford it. Yeah, less than $20.
But boy, Tightwad Hill could even afford that.
Okay, there you go. If there are people in different parts of the world who can't afford a window air conditioner or the electricity, or even the electricity to run one, you know, we want to bring air conditioning to the masses.
You have a caller. Caller, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
I didn't lose the call. So this is Dr. Juris from Montana, and this is Luis Rio Frio. So have at it, John.
Hi there. As I understand that your positive pressure suit is something similar to the web suit that was bandied about several decades ago. And my recollection of that suit is that it had some problems with providing adequate counter pressure to the armpit, around the neck, and the groin. And would you have the same kinds of problems with your suit?
Okay, to answer the first part of your question, yes, it's an idea that's been around for a while. In fact, Jaeger and some of the pilots of the X-1 wore a very primitive counter-pressure suit, which was very uncomfortable.
Right, it's a partial pressure suit, yeah.
That's right. Yes, the web suit built in the late 60s, yeah, they had issues with those areas. And, yeah, we've been working on mechanisms, yeah, specifically for areas like the armpit and the groin to directly address that. And without going into too much detail, it's definitely a soluble problem.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, John. What's involved in making a positive pressure suit and sort of get accepted in mainstream? Again, it's kind of like the orthodoxy has the status quo. So I'm aware of the traditional spacesuit manufacturers, and I'm aware of two other companies that are working to make more traditional spacesuits, for the suborbital market. One of them is really design conscious and appearance conscious, and the other one is more functionality. But I'm aware of two of those companies, and they don't, they don't see the mechanical suit as offering something for the space tourist passenger, although, to my way of thinking, if it can be made to work, it's ideal, and the passengers would love it because it's lightweight and it's not huge and bulky. And and the companies would like it. It weighs a lot less, and it doesn't require all of the infrastructure that a real pressure-fed spacesuit requires.
Yes, we think it has a lot of attraction for the tourist market. I mean, those people paying for that suborbital ticket want to be astronauts. They want to put on a nice-looking spacesuit and have that right stuff moment where they first stride out in their suits.
Do you any idea of what a mechanical pressure suit, if it were perfected and ready to go mainstream, how much do they weigh, and what kind of cost would a company be looking for? Or would the space tourist, for example, would that be part of their space tourist cost, and then they would keep the suit? Do they come in sizes, or would it be custom fit to the person?
Well, there'll be some basic sizes, and hopefully with automatic tailoring, we can make adjustments for the size of the person. And our goal for cost is to keep it around 1% of the cost of a suborbital ticket, low enough so a tourist could consider paying extra to keep his suit, you know, wear it as a souvenir for the grandchildren. And, yes, we think it would be an excellent memento of the trip into space.
What needs to be completed in a mechanical pressure suit system to have it operational, or is it actually an operational product now?
Well, it has not been tested in full spaceflight conditions. It's still a research project. We're building various components, testing them individually. Eventually, the full suit will be tested in pressure chambers and then flown in high-altitude aircraft to altitudes very close to the vacuum of space.
We're coming up on the end of this segment with KKNW, but you have this question that came in by email from Sally in San Diego. And Sally says, David, please back up with your guest. Many of us don't know what a mechanical pressure suit is and how it would differ from a traditional spacesuit like we see space shuttle people wearing when they get on and off the space shuttle. Can you please explain what a mechanical pressure suit is and how it's different from a traditional spacesuit? You want to do that, Louise?
Oh, certainly. Now the standard suit, which you see the astronauts wear, relies on air pressure. Now the mechanical suit, or the MCP suit, uses direct pressure from the suit. It's made of material somewhat similar to elastic. Direct pressure from the suit, rather than air pressure, protects you from the vacuum of space. This allows to build a suit that's form-fitting, flexible, more comfortable, and actually safer. Even if you manage to make a hole in the suit, there's no pressure to lose. You would just get local damage directly beneath the hole, so basically a big zit.
And so it doesn't, so you can actually walk in it. It doesn't clamp down on you then. Is that the idea, like an air-fed suit?
Yes, it's more comfortable. When moving, you don't have to fight the suit.
But now your helmet is still a traditional space helmet, correct?
Yes, and if you look at it closely, there's a very tight rubber seal around the neck, which isolates the helmet from the rest of the suit. And the helmet has an independent air supply.
So the helmet is pressurized like a traditional suit?
Yes.
Now, when you said that you had a flip-up visor, most spacesuits have a roll-up visor, right? And most helmets that I've put on. Or the visor or the glasses and faceplate are fixed, and you can't move it.
NASA has requested a single suit system for both within the spacecraft, so-called intravehicular activity, and also EVA. And for the same helmet to be worn, a flip-up visor is best, because astronauts like the comfort of being able to open their visor when needed to. For the suborbital tourists, we want an automatically closing visor. So if something happened to the atmosphere and the tourist was incapacitated, the visor would automatically close.
Louise, hold on. We're going to break from KKNW at this point and take our break at the top of the hour here, and then we'll be back in a couple of minutes. Those of you listening on the computer, stay with us. We'll be back for the special edition in about 2 minutes. Those of you that are leaving us on KKNW, the show will be archived and made available in its entirety later this evening at our website, thespaceshow.com. So check it out. And then, of course, we will be back live next Monday. So thank you all in Seattle for listening. Everybody else, stay right where you are. Back in 2 minutes with Louise Riofrio.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to the Space Show. I'm the host, David Livingston. Our guest today is Luis Rio Frio, and we're talking about quite a few subjects, and we have a caller with us. He's not the caller that we had trouble with connecting earlier in the show, so for that person, the line is still available. Hopefully you'll call in before the show ends. But Alan Kreider is with us. Alan, welcome back to the program. How you doing?
I'm doing well, David.
You have a question or comment for Luis?
Yes, Luis. The question I have, since you're focusing this towards the forest market, are you going to have any like special things done to the suit to provide like health care needs in case of emergency, or is that put your suit too far out of the market for affordability?
Okay. Oh, sorry, you talked about special needs in case of what?
Emergency needs, basically. If you had an in-flight emergency, would your suit be, you know, like have a built-in respirator type or defibrillator or something like that in case of those moments?
Yes, in fact, that is one of the great advantages of wearing a spacesuit to go suborbital. You know, as you know, when you go up in a jet aircraft, there has to be that cup that falls from the ceiling in case something happens to their atmosphere.
Exactly.
On a suborbital flight, well, you will need a pressure suit. And one thing I discussed earlier, we want a flip-open visor, which closes automatically in case something happens to the pressure and the wearer is incapacitated. And, well, having a flexible suit offers a lot of advantages in emergency. If you need to get out in a hurry, you can get out to a smaller opening. You certainly have more flexibility if you need any sort of emergency situation. And,
right.
Oh, even if someone needs an injection, a hypodermic goes straight through the suit.
Really?
Without compromising its pressure.
That's like a self-sealing puncture on a tire, right?
Yes.
Same principle?
Yes. The suit can actually suffer small holes. And again, even if you manage to make a hole in the suit, it will not lose pressure. You would just have local damage from a vacuum exposure. Again, basically a big zip. But of course, if you had a hole in a standard suit or any of those other suits, well, if you had a hole in that, well, don't name a high school after you.
what pressure would the suit operate on? It has to have some sort of pressure in there anyway. Would it be like 1 PSI, 5 PSI?
No pressure. But
no
pressure. Luis can answer it.
Oh, our present goal is 3 PSI.
So I was wrong. So how does it get to 3 PSI?
Well, it's made of materials very similar to elastic. And the materials actually respond to pressure. So it's not particularly tight when you put it on, which allows for ease of donning. But if it's exposed to vacuum, whether on purpose in an airlock cycling down or in a depressurization emergency, the individual parts of the suit will tighten up on you to compensate in proportion to the loss of pressure.
Okay, so when it tightens up, it equals about 3 PSI, but you don't have any air pressure flowing into it at 3 PSI.
Oh, that's correct.
Okay, so that's a clarification, because I know the conventional spacesuit has the air pressure flowing into it, And I've actually, with Pablo up at UND, put on some parts of the spacesuit at 4 PSI, and you can't move in it. I mean, it's like being inside a fire hose. So I would hate to have to quickly run out of a damaged spaceship on the ground with an inflated spacesuit. That is for sure.
Yeah, the higher the pressure, definitely the more fatigue the astronaut goes through in his hands and maneuvering around, because he's fighting the suit first thing, fighting the stiffness that the higher pressure creates. I was at a Mars conference, and they were talking about suits being modified, even having preset medication in the suit for a variety of different medical emergencies that might happen on a surface of the moon or Mars or such, and to have suits be able to automatically give a little bit of adrenaline or something like that, medication, in case an astronaut would break their leg or something like that, to have areas that could tighten up and act as a tourniquet already built into the suit. It was a very interesting thing, because it shows really that much more than just the covering, we haven't really script some of the stuff that you know, you may have out happen in the space arena, in the vacuum of space, where you're going to have to help somebody medically or sit there and watch them die.
Yes, there are a lot of issues which a spacesuit can address. Of course, decompression sickness is a big concern. If an astronaut is exposed to a vacuum somehow and gets the bends, hopefully he could be put into a suit. The suit's pressure could be raised to help him to compensate.
Can you use a mechanical pressure suit for an EVA activity, or that wouldn't work?
It can be used for emergency EVAs or short-duration EVAs. You know, for a planned or a long-period EVA, you'll need outer layers for protection from extremes of heat, micrometeorites, extreme radiation.
So it wouldn't be suitable for the Hubble telescope repair?
No, because they'll go off for EVAs for 5 to 6 hours or more, you know, passing in and out of the day and night side of the Earth.
So you had mentioned the outer skin developing different types for different types of job requirements, whether it's floating next to the station or, you know, digging a mine somewhere on Mars or the moon.
You'd have one inner layer, which is comfortable enough even to wear around inside your spacecraft, the way air crews wear flight suits around the squadron. And you're going to have adaptable outer layers. One outer layer for zero-G EVA, like a Hubble repair, and an outer layer adapted for Mars. You would use that while you were on Mars. When you're finished on Mars, you could leave those outer layers behind with all that Martian dust, and you would still have a spacesuit to return home in.
Nice. Do you have a website out there? Because I'm looking at the website that was up that David put for the program, but I'd certainly like to learn more about your suit styles and otherwise, if they're available.
Well, while you're on the website, just do a search under spacesuit. That will lead you to articles describing the suit. There will also be photos of July 4th when the suit was put on display at the Air and Space Museum, and also of this summer from the Space Development Conference in D.C.
Well, we'd love to see your site also, if you could consider taking it to the conference for the Space Frontier Foundation. We'd love to have it there, too.
Well, see what I can fit into my work schedule. Do you remember offhand when that is?
Usually it's July 18th through the 20th or so.
Do you know what location that'll be?
It's probably going to be Las Vegas next year, or this coming year, rather.
That's right. Louise, you can walk up and down the Strip.
Okay.
And I'll walk with you, because that would be really cool. I'll walk with you as you walk up and down the Strip. You'll be air-conditioned, of course. I won't be. And it'll be 120 degrees outside. This will be a total test of your product. You'll have booming sales.
Well, Las Vegas could use some sort of space attraction. They just closed down the Star Trek Experience.
Now, I did not know that. They did close that down?
Oh, yes. Such a shame. That's been going for about 10 years.
Yeah, I've been to it several times over at the Hilton Hotel. Why did they close it down? Do you know?
No, I can't think of a good reason. It still seemed very popular when I was there in August, but I think...
David, they need the real space to start coming into their realm. That's
yeah, well, hey, Alan... We all need
science fiction.
We all need real space, Alan. Get a grip.
We need to really mobilize and start seeing programs across the country that relate to supporting space and what it can really do for the world.
Alan, we all need real space. Get a grip.
Well, I can agree with you there. If you remember the 1960s, there was support for space everywhere. Why, in the very first James Bond movie, the villain was trying to shoot down America's spacecraft. Dr. No.
That's right. That was one cool movie. I saw it in a drive-in movie with a date. Can you imagine a drive-in movie today?
Yes, and I sometimes look at those old TV programs in the 1960s. Johnny Quest, Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, all those shows. There'd be, even I Dream of Jeannie was about the space program. So it was throughout the culture. The whole culture was behind going to the moon into space.
I can't believe the Hilton got rid of the Star Trek Adventure. It was actually a very, very good ride. So I'm sorry to hear that.
I am as well.
Alan, what else do you have for us?
I'm done. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
Thank you for calling.
All right.
That frees up our toll-free line, everyone, 1-866-687-7223. Louise, why do you think that, space was the way it was, back in the days of Dr. No, and it is the way it is now? Is there just too much competing for our attention when space back there was really unique and a really exciting adventure, and today there's too many unique, exciting adventures? Or what do you think the cause for the difference in interest level is?
Well, I'm going to space, making a goal like going to the moon, as John Kennedy mentions in the introduction to the show, that requires a commitment, not just for a president, but straight down the line. Right down just to the people watching on TV and individually supporting it. And if we commit, to going to space, that will go down through society. You'll see more space shows on TV, more talk about space in the media. I mean, certainly there were distractions in the 1960s. Everything from, the Vietnam War to all the other issues. But somehow, with all that happened in the 1960s, the world as one supported going to the moon. And that can happen again. If in the next 10 to 11 years we send men and women to the moon, I believe we'll see the same kind of support.
A lot of people say we got to bypass the moon and go to a near-Earth object or Mars, and to hell with the moon. Do you think going to a Neo or Mars would make a difference?
Yes, it would, but I think going to the moon supports both those goals. In the case of going to a near-Earth object, the hardware we're developing for going to the moon can easily be adapted for a mission to a near-Earth object, and that is something I very much support. I mean, that's something that the next president could get behind and make it his own initiative. And as far as going to Mars, well, when we go to Mars, we want it to be to stay, for people to settle there semi-permanently or even permanently. There's a good argument for sending people to Mars one way, just as an economical way of settling Mars. And the way to learn to do that is on the moon, on a place which is, only 2 or 3 days away, so we can practice the skills for living on another world but still be only a couple of days from Earth.
A lot of people make that case, but then a lot of other people disavow that as being relevant, and it's off to Mars we go, hi-ho, hi-ho, or the Neo, which would be very inspiring, they say. So, which brings me to another line of questioning, because I know how you have actually used physics and taught physics to school kids, and you clearly do out-of-the-box inspiring teaching techniques. So talking about inspiring a younger group of kids into science and into space, you're right up there with the very best of them. How do you inspire kids in school to want to study physics, to do the math, to do the work, to believe that they can do it so that they can go forward and develop things in space and in science and in cosmology? Because you really have used some unusual techniques.
Why, thank you. But well, one thing I do is reduce the most complicated issues of the universe to equations so simple a child could understand them. And a lot of it involved just, making science, what it is, fun and sexy. I found that when wearing the spacesuit at places like the Air and Space Museum, you'd be surprised, how many children respond to the spacesuit. It's almost as if they're hardwired to respond to the suit. Even if children have no idea what a spacesuit is for, they're somehow attracted to it. Almost as if we had some genetic calling to wear the spacesuit.
So, assuming your air conditioning was okay, you could teach a class wearing the spacesuit and really hold their attention.
Yes, in fact, I've even given talks in the suit.
Really?
In fact, I'm thinking of joining, there's a Space Ambassadors program, which I'm going to be part of, which will involve a giving talks to school audiences. And yes, a lot of them would be in the suit. If our friend was at the Mars Society conference in UCLA in 2007, he would have seen me give a lecture in the suit.
I was there. That's right, you did give a lecture in the suit. I was in that lecture. I remember that. I'd forgotten all about that. That was over Labor Day at UCLA.
That's right.
Interesting. Now, everybody flocks to that suit. It is a true magnet, and what a teaching opportunity it arises. Can those suits be made in color if the individual tourist was going to end up owning it as a memento of their trip to suborbital space and said, I want a green one or a red one? Can that be done, or are they all silver like the one that you model?
Oh, they can be made in any color. For a suborbital tourism, they could be made in corporate colors. Just as old-time airlines, like to have a marketing plan with individualized uniforms and logos. We can apply that marketing scheme directly to the suit, make it any color you like. Oh, some people, might want to make custom suits in their own color scheme. And yes, we can make it almost any reasonable color.
Bob in Boulder, Colorado, says, I'm looking at the picture of you on the website at the museum in the spacesuit. I'm wondering, have you decided to license an imitation commercial knockoff for a Halloween costume as a spacesuit for kids and adults to use? I think that would be a grand transition novelty item that would really make kids aware and even people aware of changes in space clothing as well as space access.
Yes, that's an excellent idea. I've thought about I'm more focused on the science, and it's a bit too late for this year's Halloween. But yes, if any toy maker or costume maker, wishes to license that design, we'd be happy to talk with them. We want to get the children interested in space, if that includes building space toys and even space costumes. Well, we did that in the 1960s, and we can do that again.
Do you think that if we go back to your cosmology theories for a minute, how easy is it for you to teach that to school kids, and what age would be a cutoff point? Would you only do that with high school or middle school kids, or could you actually take grade school kids and start teaching them the basics of dark matter and the speed of light and some of your cosmology work? I'm just wondering how young you can successfully introduce this to children and get them to actually understand what is being said to them.
Well, the very basics can be taught to young children without mathematics. I do a demonstration where I explain the universe like a giant ball in four dimensions rather than three, where we live on the surface of the ball. And yes, I explain the principles of a sphere and how we can extend those to four dimensions using as examples what an ant would feel like crawling on the surface of a sphere. And, yeah, for the equations, well, like gm equals tc cubed and r equals ct, that requires a middle school student, someone who's had a first course in algebra. But at all ages, we try to keep it simple. One reason I think this theory is becoming more and more successful is because it is understandable. And it's something that we can explain to a wide variety of audiences.
Now, the theory is fully explained on your website that I announced a little while ago, which is riofriospacetime.blogspot.com, right?
Right.
So, and if people have questions or comments, can they contact you through your website, or do you give out an address, or how does that work?
Oh, they're welcome to leave comments on the website.
So they can, if they have a follow-up question or comment from this show, for example, they can do so on the blog on your website.
Yes, that's an excellent place.
Okay. Do you have any plans to do any formal teaching when you go to Houston, or is it strictly just a sideline that you do in addition to your regular work?
Well, I am a full-time paid scientist, which means I don't have to teach classes. You do give lectures and public interest events, you know, as a sideline, but I'm full-time into research. That's what they pay me for.
So you're not officially a teacher?
No, not at this time.
And you went to Cal, right?
Oh, yes, I went there.
So everybody, you're just so that you'll know, she is a graduate of Berkeley, and, you know, we're talking out-of-the-box physics and cosmology, but we're talking about the real thing. So I just wanted to sort of put the credentials out there that this is the real thing. When did you come across your ideas for the speed of light in your theory? How long have you been developing this theory?
Oh, quite a long time, since I was an undergraduate. You know, I took advantage of my time there to read almost everything I could find on space and physics. You know, even out-of-the-box theories. I read about Paul Dirac and the first Lord Kelvin, people who have speculated about the speed of light. By learning from those ideas, learning what had already been done and trying other ideas, I was able to come up with things that were unusual and very, very exciting.
If the speed of light can be variable, even if by just tiny amounts, do you ever foresee us being able to figure out a way to approach the speed of light or travel at the speed of light?
Well, approaching the speed of light, all it requires is energy. I mean, in fact, that's perfectly allowable under relativity. A spacecraft can get very close to the speed of light, but the closer you get, the more energy it requires. The biggest problem in building a starship is generating that much energy. I believe in Star Trek they relied on antimatter. And I'm thinking if we built our own starship, if tiny black holes turn out to be commonplace, all we'd need to do is capture one, and we'd have all the energy we could use.
You make it sound very simple. But remember, Star Trek had the lithium crystals and Scotty. And Scotty is dead and crossed over, and I don't know where you mine the crystals, do you?
No, so I haven't tried to build a warp drive just yet, but I'm just thinking about things that are doable.
How about a replicator? Could you build that? I mean, think of the market value you could have for that.
Not yet, but I worked with a 3D prototyping machine, three-dimensional copiers, and they're getting pretty close.
Really?
I don't know if you've tried those machines, but they can produce you a good pair of shoes right down to the rubber.
No, are you serious?
Yes, in fact, that's the technology I've been pushing for going back to the moon. These devices exist now.
Tell us about this. Again, I've not ever heard this talked about on the show either.
Oh, it's a fairly new technology, but three-dimensional prototyping. You know, a machine that just builds products and layers of plastic or similar materials. So you just insert a CAD file, and it produces whatever you want. So if someday, you know, you want to produce your own astronaut action figure, you might have a device in your home. Just program it in. It'll produce the figure right in your home.
So what do? You put the raw materials in? Like, let's say I'm going to laminate something. I put the laminating material in there and then put the item I want, my driver's license, I want ever to be laminated. Is that kind of a real rough analogy?
Yes. But, well, laminating machines are relatively simple. You see
well, yeah,
everywhere.
Of course. So you put the raw materials in the machine for the shoe, and then you put a CAD drawing of the shoe in for your size and width, and you come out with the shoe?
Yes.
Come on. Are you really for real? This really is going on?
Oh, yeah. I touched the shoe, tried it on. I don't have it on me, but I do have a keychain made of the same material.
How do you get it to be the color you want?
Well, coloring's fairly easy. You just inject a dye into the material.
Could you do this with an aspirin tablet, for example? Or could you do this with food?
Not with food just yet, but oh, I'm sure someone's working on a food replicator. Right now, they're working on simple plastic or rubber products, you know, things like, which would be an enormous help either, you know, if you're on the moon or even in your own home. Imagine in your own home you had a device costing about as much as a desktop computer that could produce, glasses, goblets, shoes, boots, spoons.
You may need to watch out. We may be able to produce your space
suit.
So 3D...
all about it.
You're...
Oh, not the first one. Oh, you'd be amazed. Even death was on a clock.
How long does it take, say, to replicate a shoe from the drawing?
Oh, it depends exactly which model machine, but maybe 40 minutes.
I'm amazed. I guess one should no longer be amazed anymore.
Yeah, imagine what an advantage that would be on a moon base. Imagine if they could just produce their own products.
But you got to have the raw material for the products. I mean, it's not... That's the drawback there. You still have to get the raw material of the products to the moon.
Yes, and hopefully, in exploring the moon, we'll find the raw materials we can use. But it still makes things simpler if you can just keep a tank of raw material somewhere and use it to make anything you want.
Well, clearly, and if you can avoid the labor cost and the finished mass weight to lift to space or to the moon, it would probably be a lot lower in cost as well. I would think over that. As we move toward the end of the program today, I always like to ask our guests to give us some concluding remarks or pearls of wisdom, as I like to call them. What would you like to leave us with today, and what would be your concluding remarks?
Well, I'd say, in the world, it's always easy to get downbeat, to get negative, to put down and new ideas. But history shows that, we can do things. We can do great things. In space, we can reach the moon, again, go to near-Earth objects, and eventually to settle the moon and Mars. In science, someone, even the most unexpected someone can come up with an idea that can solve all sorts of problems and eventually lead to a better life through science. And that's something, we need to encourage. We need to seek out that sort of talent, nurture it, encourage it, because... we, meaning all of us, we're capable of great and unexpected things.
Louise, when you settle in Houston, let me know where you are, and we'll do this down the road.
Oh, I'd love to.
And I want to thank you for being on the program today. And there are a lot of cool space conferences that you ought to think about modeling your spacesuit. Even the Responsive Space Conference with all the military and high corporate people in L.A. in April. They want responsive space, and now the DOD is actively talking again about being able to transport a fully equipped platoon of soldiers from point A to point B through space. So they're going to need some sort of protective gear other than their military uniforms. Spacesuit is so, responsive space might be a place for you to spin some heads in April. Down in Los Angeles, you might think about it.
Oh, yes, I can. Oh, maybe they saw the movie Iron Man. I know how to build that. that bit about Iron Man flying through the air in his suit? I mean, that's not science fiction. That can be done.
He can fly through the air?
In fact, he could fly a lot faster and a lot farther than Iron Man.
How does he fly through the air? For real, how would you do that?
Well, it's just as he says in the movie. You know, you don't need a spacecraft to go into space if you have a good enough suit. And if you were looking for an economical way to reach space, do it in your suit and don't carry that heavy spacecraft. The view is much better.
Amazing. We'll save that thought for the next show, okay? I will make a note of it.
All right.
Louise, thank you very much for being with us on the Space Show today.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Listeners, that's it for today. Tomorrow, author Gregory Burns is with us, his new book, Iconoclast. And guess who has a feature 4 or 5 or 6 pages in it? None other than Rita Anderson, the grandma who wants to be a space tourist for suborbital space traffic. Actually, I think, Louise, you've met Rita at different space conferences.
Oh, yes, I did.
And she's got 4 or 5 pages in Greg's new book. So that's it again for today. Thank you to Louise Riofrio and everybody for listening. Back again tomorrow night. Goodbye from the Space Show.